Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D. I'm Henry Rees Sheridan on my own today, with Josh having fled the country, a temporary measure, he assures me. On today's show, we get comfortable with a mainstay in the world of industrial design and chart the history, meaning and importance of the humble chair.
50% of everybody that's employed in the developed economies of the world work at a desk. And what does that mean? They all need a chair.
That was Peter Feel. He's the author of the renowned Taschen coffee table staple 1000 Chairs, and he tells us how chairs have developed over time and why they're so important. We also hear from Knud Erik Hansen, the CEO of Danish furniture manufacturer Carl Hansen & Son. We talk to him about his company's values and how the law can protect designers from copycats. Then
we started off with piling up books on the floor and putting a couple of planks here and there and just working out the heights of the chair and everything.
Lauded ceramicist Reiko Kaneka there, she's recently made the move to furniture design and explains how she went about designing her first chair. Plus, we head to Belgrade to hear about some innovative public benches in the city. All that coming up right here on Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. What is it about chairs? No other object seems to capture the imagination of designers in quite the same way, and a stab at a chair design is still considered a rite of passage for a young designer to pass through. In 1997, Taschen published 1000 Chairs, a book that collated 1000 of the best chairs of the modern period, dedicating a page to each. It was edited by Charlotte and Peter Feel, editors in charge of design books at Taschen from 1993 to 2007. Monocle's design editor, Josh Fennett, spoke to Peter to learn more about the history of the chair. Josh began by asking what gives the chair its particular appeal as a design object.
It's actually a massive subject. And I mean, let me just try to contextualize that for you and your listeners. In the developed economies of the world, half of all people that are in employment work at a desk. 50% of everybody that's employed in the developed economies of the world work at a desk. And what does that mean? They all need a chair. That's massive. I mean, that gives you a sense of how big the chair industry is. And I'm not even talking about domestic. This is pure contract office seating, okay? So there's these two worlds out there. By far the biggest and most profitable, most technologically driven world is the world of office chairs. Then there's the world of domestic chairs that we have in our homes. And we have all sorts of different kinds of chairs for different occasions. We have dining chairs, we have lounge chairs, we have side chairs, we have, you know, if you include sofas as, you know, I include all seat furniture kind of as chairs. So you have all these different kinds of chairs in our homes, but then you also have beyond, you know, say office tasking chairs in the contract world, different kinds of contract chairs. You have auditorium type chairs, you have airport beam seating, you have conference chairs, you know, on and on and on. There's all these different types of chairs. And all of them are basically designed to do the one thing, which is to support the human body in a healthful way, with the weight coming down the spine to the pelvis and hips, and to be supported, you know, with the legs hanging freely and touching the floor. The aim is to create a chair that's as universal as possible, and that always has been the case. If you look at the most successful chairs of all time, there's roughly 10, and these are fairly well known. I mean, I always start with the Michael Tone number 14 chair. This was the very basic Bentwood cafe chair. Everyone knows them, designed in 1859. I mean, what was remarkable about that chair was that it was comprised of only like 6 elements.
And if I remember rightly, this one was very stackable. So in an era of industrialization, people are able to ship them off in vast numbers.
Something like 38 could be disassembled and packed into a 1 meter cubic crate, which was astonishing, really. And then the price of the chair, because they were able to mass produce them in such volume, a price of a number 14 chair in the day was about the same price as a bottle of wine. I mean, that's amazing. So, okay, then the next one, technically, was the Marcel Breuer B3 Vasily chair, you know, bent tubular metal, 1925. After that, 1940, Charles Eames and Eero Saarinen produced arguably the most important chairs of all time, which were prototypes and never more than that, for the 1940 Organic Design and Home Furnishings competition at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. And they produced a series of four or five different types of molded plywood chairs with monocoque compound molded seat shells. They were important because they were lined with foam rubber, and there was no other means of, you know, like, there was no other kind of upholstery. And what they were promoting was continuous contact and support, which was arguably one of the most important events in the whole history of chair design. Next up is the 1945 LCW by Charles Eames. Everybody knows it, compound molded plywood. Then I think the next most important chair, arguably the most important group of chairs of all time, was the 1948 to 1950 Eames plastic shell group of chairs. And why do I say that? Because that was the first ever large scale thing mass produced in plastic. I mean, forget the fact it was a chair. That alone, the fact it was the first mass produced thing in plastic, would make it seriously important in the history of design. But then it was a chair. But it was more than a chair. It was a program of seating with interchangeable bases, sort of a universal shell, one with arms and one without, many, many, many different interchangeable bases. That was the first ever majorly important seating program.
It's been the quest of these designers to create what you described as design unity, to create a singular perfect vision for what a chair might be. You have, with your studies and with your publishing and with a rather wonderful book that's available from Taschen, distilled 10 chairs that are of importance. But I wonder if, just for the sake of the show, you could give us one of your favourites and tell us why. And tell us why that's design unity to you, why you think it's a perfect.
Well, one of the chairs that are, in fact, arguably the last most important chair on my list is the Jasper Morrison Air Chair of 1999. So this is a single form, single piece, very importantly, gas assist injection molded chair. So it's a glass reinforced polypropylene. It's very technical. It was a major, major innovation. Great for Jasper to have done that. But my buddy Ross Lovegrove then took that concept of the gas assist injection molded chair and made it sexy. And that's Ross Lovegrove's Supernatural Chair of 2005. That is, I think, right now, my most favorite chair. Not just because he's a good guy and he's a friend of mine, but I mean, it's an astonishingly beautiful chair, and it's, you know, it's absolutely fat-free. There's not a scrap of unnecessary material there. It's a pure sort of essentialist design. It's right up Ross's, you know, street. It's typical of his work, and it's absolutely gorgeous. And it's available in an incredible, you know, range of lovely colors and perfectly functional inside and out. It stacks. It's a wonderful chair.
That was Peter Feel, editor of the Taschen book 1000 Chairs. As we heard from Peter, chair design has developed hand in hand with chair manufacturing technology. But the ability to mass produce chairs has brought with it copycat manufacturers willing to rip off original designs and undermine traditional makers. This is something nude Erik Hansen knows all too well. He's the CEO of Carl Hansen & Son, a Danish furniture maker and the largest manufacturer of furniture by renowned Danish designer Hans J. Wegner. He joined me on the line from New York to discuss the brand's values and the threat posed by copycat producers. But first, he told me about the company's reissue of Wegner's CH22 lounge chair, which he was in the city to promote.
We are reissuing it for many reasons, and the most important one is perhaps that it was the actual first chair we received from Hans J. Wegner in 1949. And it has some fantastic characteristics. You can see in the chair that inspirations for other chairs he has designed is actually present in that chair. And therefore, it is a very unique, it's very, very unique chair, and of course also a difficult chair to make. But it is something which has a speciality for us because it is the absolute first chair we got. Today, of course, we produce the chair with exactly the same details as they did in those days. But we have a few more means to ease the process, because you have today fantastic machines, you have beautiful facilities which they didn't have in those days. So it's perhaps a little bit easier today, because if we were to do it the way they did it in 1950, we wouldn't be able to pay for the chair.
This manufacturing and these lovely new machines that you speak of are in your new facility in Gelsted in Denmark, a facility that you reinvested in 2014, and we covered that in the magazine. Now, you own the licenses, not only to this Hans J. Regnicket chair, but many other classic furniture designs.
Yes.
There's recently been a new law passed in the UK extending the copyright protection of furniture designs from unlicensed manufacturer from 25 to 75 years. This is in response to the an acknowledgement of the drain that copycat manufacturing was having on the design of furniture industry. Is that an issue for your company?
It is, of course. I would say at the moment we are, of course, feeling the copying from the Far East, from China and other of the Far Eastern countries. The quality that they produce does not match what we are doing. And I can say they sell on price, and the only thing we don't sell at is the price. We are competing with others on quality. And therefore, there is a big difference between the two products. Although they look alike, they are certainly not alike. But it is annoying, especially in markets where we are making an entry, if the copies are already there. That is very, very annoying for us, because it is making life much more expensive for us and difficult, because people expect the low prices as well. So we are worldwide traders. We are not an enormous company. We are a small-sized company, and many of these copycats have companies that are much, much bigger and much more powerful than we are. And that is annoying as well. It actually is, we use a lot of money on lawyers and on refraining, getting people to understand what we stand for, which would have been different if there wasn't copies around. So we actually focus sometimes on something which we actually are not really in the mood of using for promoting our own products, but to try and keep the others away, and that's no fun.
In spite of these kind of challenges, are you optimistic that there's a bright future for your company keeping manufacturing in Denmark?
Yes, I think so, because it is a very, very expensive place to produce. But we have fantastic craftsmen. And, you know, I bought the Ruud Rasmussen factory, a small factory in Copenhagen, which is about 150 years old and have produced in the same spot ever since. I think that that would show how skilled the craftsmen are in Denmark. It would also illustrate where our cradle was 108 years ago when Carl Hansen was founded. And these traditions and methods and things that we use are something you can't find anywhere else in the world. We, of course, have to, can you say, also modernize and be up to date. And so when you get to see the Carl Hansen factories, the new factories which we have done, they are ultra modern. They have the most fancy machinery doing all the, can you say, the heavy work, which is hard to a human being to do. It wears people out, and all these heavy-duty methods are done by machines today. But as soon as we start assembling the furniture and surfacing and weaving and upholstering, it is exactly the same as we did 150 years ago. And that means the quality is extremely high. And that's what we go for, because that's one of the really key points where we can compete.
That was Knud Erik Hansen, CEO of Danish furniture manufacturer Carl Hansen & Son. Still to come, designer Reiko Kaneko takes us through the process of designing her first chair, and we head to Belgrade to check out a design-minded and tech-savvy bench.
What is culture with Robert Bound?
This is the show of shows.
There was something really magical about it.
Everybody's boozing, having grand adulterous love affairs. There's fabulous fist fights, and everybody is smoking opium.
How did that get in there?
Well, we're not enjoying the after party. We're on an intrepid investigation each week to answer questions like how do you adapt a novel and how do you start an art collection? Culture with Robert Bound is your one-stop shop for the answers to the cultural questions that leave you scratching your head every day. Grab a drink, pull up a chair, and tune in every Monday at 1900 London time.
So how exactly do you go about designing a chair? To find out, we turned to Reiko Kaneko. She made her name as a ceramicist, but has recently turned her hand to chair design in a collaboration with renowned London-based modern furniture manufacturer and retailer SCP. Reiko joined me on the line from her factory in Stoke-on-Trent in England to tell me about making the transition from ceramicist to furniture designer.
I'm originally a ceramic designer. I wasn't classically trained ceramicist, but I stumbled into it after university, being drawn into ceramics kind of perhaps from my Japanese background. I'm half Japanese and English, and found a functioning kind of industry in Stoke-on-Trent. And I moved up here from London about 4 years ago now, specialising in ceramics. But recently I've been asked by SCP to design a piece of furniture. It is feather cushion and it's a tubeless steel construction, so it has a little flex to it. It's got quite a light footprint and is light as well, kind of in weight also.
And how do you develop the idea of a chair from conception to completion? Do you begin with a sketch or some other way of noting down
idea? We started with a sketch, but I think it is difficult doing a completely different medium. I was quite stumped actually with trying to design a new piece of furniture because you kind of start to develop your own style, I suppose, in ceramics, and you kind of understand what works and what doesn't. But with furniture, we started with sketch and I produced it on a 3D program, kind of started constructing it and got the look of it and the kind of the vibe of the chair going forward. But it's the ergonomics, you know, we started off with piling up books on the floor and putting a couple of planks here and there and just working out the heights of the chair and everything. So, yeah, it was a long process. Sheridan probably approached me in 2013, and it was about 2 years of that kind of process of working out exactly what my message would be in the furniture and how I wanted to kind of produce a chair that was comfortable, kind of felt like it was kind of modern, I guess, as well.
And one big difference between producing ceramics and designing a chair is how profound the structural considerations that you have to take into account are. Obviously, people of perhaps varying different weights are going to come and eventually sit on this chair, hopefully. Do you have to consult any, I don't know, engineers or outside specialists with regards to this?
Obviously, SCP has a great specialist team who kind of produces furniture and designs everything, and actually the upholsterers and the team there in Suffolk who produces the chairs were quite integral to kind of helping me with various aspects of it. And if you look at me and Sheridan as well, we're quite different in body shape, so it was quite interesting having to, you know, bearing in mind everything, all the different body shapes and the weights and the heights and the differences in the distance between, say, your foot and your knee. So it was an interesting process. And in a way, that was quite interesting about this project because I'm so kind of inside the ceramics industry and, you know, I'm kind of au fait with all the problems that it throws up, but that furniture is a completely different situation. And it kind of, that interdisciplinary creativity definitely kind of magnifies my spirit in a sense that it kind of is exciting and, yeah.
You mentioned that you were approached by SCP. Now, is this an isolated response to a particular brief, a kind of passion project? Or is this for you a step in a direction that you want to take further?
As I say, it was a challenge from Sheridan to make a piece of furniture for them. They have an upholstery company anyway, so they wanted me to do some sort of soft furnishing. I wanted to kind of take it down the route of a reading chair stroke lounge chair because I'd moved up to Stoke-on-Trent at the time, and without the distractions of London, I was going through books after books. it kind of came out of quite a few needs, I guess, of how we kind of live our life in a way, in a living room. It's not so static, and we're kind of moving everything around to suit our laptop and carrying sort of feel, I think.
That was designer Reiko Kaneko. Of course, the home and the office aren't the only places to find well-designed seating. For the final item on today's show, we step outdoors. Indeed, we go all the way over to Belgrade to check out some innovative public seating in the city. A bench can be more than just a place to sit. Now that public parks have Wi-Fi, it would be a shame if your mobile device ran out of power just as you were making critical progress on which nearby restaurant to sample. At times like that, what you need is a strawberry tree. Along with another design, the Strawberry Smart Bench, these solar-powered seats can charge your phone while you enjoy the view. And they're spreading from their home in Serbia to other European cities, including London. We sent our Belgrade correspondent Guy Delorni to investigate.
Belgrade is a city full of green spaces, and if you come and visit here, you're bound to find yourself wandering through at least one of them. And in these parks and green spaces, you'll notice something very striking. A metal tree with a lid on the top. But in fact, the lid on the top is a solar panel array. The tree is supporting it. And next to the tree, you'll find a very broad, very solid bench made of pine, and this has got an array of cables running from a metal bar in the middle of it, and they're designed for charging your mobile phone or any other mobile device which you can find a connector for. And this is the work of a Serbian company called Strawberry Energy. These devices are called Strawberry Trees. Tijana Manitasevic is from Strawberry Energy. Tijana, tell us first of all how this got started, this Strawberry Tree project.
Yes, well, our founder, Miloš Milisavljević, wanted to show to people the benefits of solar energy in urban cores. So, unlike remotely placed solar power plants, we are showing people the real benefits of solar panels they can see in everyday lives. So, as you see, Strawberry Tree is made like an artificial tree, which transforms solar energy into necessary electrical energy, providing this way charging for mobile devices on the go. Apart from that, our street furniture also has sensors for various data from the environment, such as noise, CO2 levels, air pressure, temperature, humidity. So we are trying to make street furniture that is better for a 21st century mobile generation, and actually that can serve for many purposes.
The strawberry tree, though, you could have made this design extremely functional. You could have just had solar panels and somewhere to sit, but instead of which you've gone for this very striking design, which is quite beautiful really, and it fits in very nicely with this Belgrade waterfront promenade which has been newly developed. How did the design element, the aesthetic design, come into it?
Yes, well, the first challenge was to make it as comfortable for people as it can be. So that is why we have such a broad, as you see, the bench and backrest for people, so they can enjoy staying their time while staying outside. So that was also the challenge, to have this rooftop to make people, as you see, as we are now protected from some in some part.
Well, it's raining now. This is the irony. We're doing solar power and we're in the rain. But of course, Serbia has got 2,300 hours of sunshine a year, yes, generally, so usually it's a little bit of shade from the
yes
sun.
And what's interesting, I must mention that although it's raining, and even during the night and during when it's snowing, our street furniture provides energy because of built-in batteries and because of smart electronics that actually optimizes energy flow. So back to the design, we had that concept of socializing outdoors, so we wanted to make public places more sociable, where people actually are encouraged to meet, to speak with each other, to just encourage that social behavior.
What sort of challenges did you have to meet and overcome in order to make this design work in a practical sense? It's outdoors, it's got to withstand the elements, it's got to withstand the people that are using it, and it's got to stand the test of time as well.
Yes, well, we are using very resistant materials that can actually, as you see, function, resist any weather conditions. So the first device was installed in 2010. So until then, we tested tested to any kind of weather conditions, so adverse weather conditions, and we upgraded it with some protective coating for the bench and for the construction, so it can really resist anything. And the challenge was to also make the electronics work when it's not, as I said, when it's raining, snowing, when there is no sunshine. So as we are outdoors, we had to make it work around the clock, and that was the main thing we had in mind, as well as have resistant materials that can be easily maintained, of course, because cities are definitely worrying about that. So we made the materials to be just not to worry about the painting too much, and about the other parts of the tree.
I mean, one of the things that does strike you straight away when you look at the smart bench is the cables, which are running off the bar in the middle, which serves both as backrest and also for containing some of the electronics, I guess. And you've got your micro USB cable here, a nice sort of coiled up curly micro USB cable, but in a British park people will just pull these off. How do you deal with that sort of thing, just the usual vandalism that you'll get of street furniture?
Yes. It is something that is sometimes happening, but we made the cables to be easily replaceable and to be low cost. So as you said, maintenance is really at a low level. That is the only thing that can be actually vandalized, and nothing else on this tree.
What sort of reactions are you getting from the people of Belgrade who come across your strawberry trees?
Yes, reactions are really fantastic. We had so far more than 400,000 users, and we know that because of our smart electronics that actually measures the number of chargings every day.
And that's in how many years?
Yes, well, that's in 5 years, but we didn't install all the trees at once, but you know, every year a couple of trees. So far we have 23 systems installed, along with strawberry smart benches that were installed in London last year in October in cooperation with Canary Wharf Group.
So I've got three electronic devices on me, all running low on battery. My phone is at 19%. My recording machine running low, and I've got my Bluetooth headset as well. The strawberry tree will be equal to all of those?
You can do whatever you want. You can charge 16 devices here. You can charge mobile phones, Bluetooth devices, MP3 players, cameras, tablets. So you can charge everything you have, every variable you have, and go completely equipped with clean solar energy in your pocket.
You need never be out of touch again. A blessing and a curse. Tiana, thank you very much indeed. For Monocle in Belgrade, I'm Guy Delaunay.
Unfortunately, that's all we've got time for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Holly Fisher, and researcher, Maria Granina. I'd love to hear what you have to say about the show. You can email me at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next week at the same time. You can always listen again or sample our back catalogue in the meantime at monocle.com, SoundCloud and iTunes. And please leave us a review while you're there to let us know what we're getting right and wrong. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan. And until next time, it's goodbye from me.